This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, the benefits of creative art pursuits for older adults. But first,
in December of 1955, nearly 6 months after the kidnapping, murder, and subsequent trial revolving around the Negro youth, Emmett Till, and his accused killers, J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant Jr., I sat down with the two men that had been hoisted on the shoulders of white supremacy and later shunned by those same friends and neighbors. I questioned the men. I knew they did it. That answer was brutally obvious. Well, this reporter wanted to understand. Would Look magazine paid $4,000 to print, and would several million Americans plunk down 2 bits to read and gossip over ears? Why?
It was 61 years ago this month that a 14-year-old African-American youth, Emmett Till, was kidnapped and murdered by two white men in Money, Mississippi, for reportedly flirting with a white woman. An all-white male jury cleared the two men of the charges, but they later admitted their guilt. Till's tragic death served as a catalyst for the civil rights movement, which was just starting to emerge. The film Dar Heap, The Lynching of Emmett Till, is a true dramatization of the historic interviews and events surrounding the murder. The film was adopted from the one-man play written and performed by Mike Wiley. The National Underground Railroad Freedom Center is presenting a screening of the film this Saturday, followed by a conversation with Mike Wiley. And he joins us this afternoon, along with Chris Miller, Freedom Center Manager of Program Initiatives, to discuss the murder of Emmett Till and the impact it had on the country and the civil rights movement. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Mike and Chris, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Mike, tell us why you wanted to tell the story of Emmett Till.
I felt that the story for a period of time was being lost. And when I say a period of time, I mean before 2005. I wrote the play in 2005, performed it in 2006 for the first time. But prior to that, I feel like there was only a particular generation, an older generation, that really knew that story. And when they talk about that story, many of them will say the same thing. Oh, yes, my parents told me that story, or, oh, yes, I read about that story in Jet Magazine, or so on and so forth. So there was a particular age group that was losing this story. Either their parents weren't telling them or their grandparents weren't telling them, and I needed this story to come back. It was before camera phones and things of that nature, so therefore it was before we really started to take a national notice to police brutality and such. And so therefore, the play itself was taking place at a time where we were celebrating in a sense, getting over, when we weren't really getting over racism and those kinds of brutal police brutality and things of that nature were not being talked about, in a sense, because we weren't seeing it. And so therefore I needed to create a play that shined light on that again.
Chris?
Absolutely. We had the pleasure of actually having Mike perform at the Freedom Center earlier on when we opened up, and as well as a few years later. And so Mike is a brilliant performer, and I just love the fact that he takes these very meaningful yet complicated stories and bring them to life in a very creative way. I will say that, you know, there is a history and legacy of black bodies being degraded, devalued, and disregarded. And the story of Emmett Till reflects that narrative, and it connects and resonates and very relevant today when you hear about the stories of Trayvon Martin and Freddie Gray, of how these individuals in many different ways are being devalued, degraded, and disregarded.
Who was Emmett Till? What kind of a person was he, Chris?
Well, he was 14 years old. And
so he's just a kid.
Yes, he's a boy. Yeah, he's a boy. He's a teenager. 14 years old, visiting the South from Chicago, Illinois. And so he had a bit of innocence about him, with being 14 years old, not being aware of the social dynamics of living in the South. Allegedly a few gestures, alleged gestures, results in him, his life being ended at 14 years old. I think when we were talking beforehand, this story is not that old. My mother was the same age as Emmett Till in 1955. She'll be celebrating her 75th birthday this coming November. And so that makes it personal for me and for many people, outside of the fact that this is a young black boy, which I can relate to, but also the fact that I have a loved one, a dear mother, who was living during this time period and was the same age as Emmett Till in 1955.
Absolutely. You hear stories about folks like John Lewis, who was in high school, middle school, when this incident occurred, and how it empowered them to say enough is enough. Probably empowered people like Chris's mother to say enough is enough. That particular generation, said, okay, now what do we do about it? It was indeed the spark that lit the civil rights movement.
Mike, can you touch on this a little bit more about what life was like in the South in 1955 for African Americans compared to, say, in Chicago or other northern cities? I mean, and why Emmett maybe didn't realize the danger of even an innocent act?
We're talking about going into a different world, in a sense, going from Chicago to a money Mississippi, the Mississippi Delta. Even today in the Mississippi Delta, there is a sense of you're traveling down some dusty roads. There's a highway that goes straight down through the middle of it. And at night, it's pitch black, brother. I mean, we're talking about a place that is still fairly impoverished, one of the poorest high schools in the state, which means one of the poorest high schools in the country is there. So we're talking about a place that has changed, but has not changed when it comes to poverty and people living in that sense of poverty. We're also talking about a time where there was a staunch segregation. The difference between Chicago and Mississippi, we're talking individuals that taught their children, you don't walk on the same sidewalk as white people. You don't speak to white people without saying yes, sir, or no, sir. You don't do these kinds of things. So it's a different world for Emmett. Emmett's living in an integrated society in Chicago. He's going to school with white kids. He's living in communities with white kids. In the South, especially again in the Mississippi Delta, that's unheard of. The integrated schools, speaking to white folks as if you would treat them as an equal or they would treat you as an equal during that time period was just unheard of for folks in the Mississippi Delta, and especially for a kid like Emmett Till.
How did Emmett end up making that fateful trip to Money, Mississippi, Chris?
I think especially in the black community, I will say that there is this, especially with the Great Migration that starts to occur during those decades. You had a lot of black families who were moving to areas like Chicago as far as for for work, were looking for better jobs, better situations. And so they still had relatives that lived in the South. And so it was very common in a lot of situations to where children would go back to see aunts and uncles and grandparents and spend the summer there in the South. And so this was somewhat of a tradition, so to speak. And so that's how that came about. But I think it's very important to understand when you talk about the Emmett Till story, to understand the amount of hatred that the individuals had towards Emmett, not knowing him. When you read the accounts of what they've done, making him carry a 75-pound cotton gin fan to the Tallahatchie River, ordering him to take off his clothes, then beating him nearly to death, gouging out his eyes, shooting him in the head, and then throwing his body over into the river, tied to the cotton gin with a barbed wire. I mean, that is a great level of hatred towards someone you don't even know. And
this is all allegedly over he flirted with a store owner's wife, or
he said hey baby on his way out. There weren't any witnesses to collaborate the store clerk's words. So it came about her word against, Emmett Till didn't have a word. He was dead. But at the same account, if he said hey baby, is that an offense to have your life
it
taken?
It kind of sounds like something that a 14-year-old guy might just say because he's a teenager.
Absolutely.
Well, that's the thing, and that's why I felt that the story needed to be told from a solo perspective. Myself being having been once a 14-year-old kid, I wanted to explore those things thematically. And he goes into the store on a dare. It's a dare like any one of us would have taken when we were that age, a dare from his cousin saying, I dare you to go in that store, make a pass at that girl, make a pass at that woman. Who knows whether he did or not? Now, he comes out of the store and he's, and a lot of folks don't realize that Emmett has a stutter. He has mm-hmm. a stutter when he speaks.
He had polio, right? Didn't he, when he was a child?
Absolutely. And so he comes out of that store and he can barely speak, and he's stuttering, and his cousins ask him, what happened in that store? Now, keep in mind, his mother had always told him that if he needed to clear out his stutter, to whistle. And so when Carolyn Bryant comes out of that store, and she goes to her car to allegedly get a pistol from that car because of what's perhaps taken place inside the store, he whistles, and they say that he was whistling at her, and many books have been written regarding this wolf whistle, as it were, but his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, went to her grave believing that he was just clearing out a stutter, and I believe it as well, and that comes out in the film as well.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me this afternoon, actor and playwright Mike Wiley, and also Chris Miller, Freedom Center Manager for Program Initiatives, as we discuss the murder of Emmett Till and the impact it had on the country and the civil rights movement. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Troy in Evendale. Hi, Troy.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Hey, I grew up knowing the story of Emmett Till, and then actually got familiar with it kind of firsthand, I guess, or secondhand, by watching the documentary Eyes on the Prize. And so I wanted your guest to tell everyone why it's called Darkie. I'm familiar with it. I understand the connection with the guy in the show, but I wanted them to tell that. Also, I wanted to thank them for doing this and ask them if there are any connections that they see or any intentions of going into the George Stinney situation, you know, concerning what happened with George Stinney, who was also a young boy.
I'll take the first part of that. I'm intimately knowledgeable of it. It's called Darhi because Emmett's uncle, Moses Wright, testified against Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam in that courtroom. And for him to, A, testify against them was a death sentence in itself during that time in Mississippi for a black man to testify against white men. But to actually point them out in court was another layer on to that. And so he stood up in court and pointed at J.W. Milam and said, there he is, or in Southern vernacular, it would have been something like Dahi. You know, Dahi is right there in the way that they probably spoke during that time period. And so I felt that the bravery of Mose Wright needed to be reflected in the play as well as the movie. And so that's why it's called Darhi as opposed to any other particular title.
And I believe there was a second part of that question. You had referred to an individual.
He's not on the line with us anymore, Chris, but he was referring to a case. Darn, I didn't write down the name. I'm terrible. But he was asking, and maybe you can talk about it this way. Do you see any similar things? A young African American who's been killed. Any similar cases to what happened with Emmett Till?
Well, absolutely. The continuum of Emmett Till's story is reflected in a lot of stories that we see today, the Trayvon Martins of the world, and many young black men who are recklessly killed with no accountability and no justice. Because there's a couple stories to this. It's what happened to Emmett Till, but it's also the trial. And so that plays a very important role.
In this case, it was George Stinney. That's who he was referring to. George Stinney was the particular case he was asking about.
Okay, George Stinney. I don't want to I'm not too familiar with George Stinney in that particular case. And so it would be difficult for me to speak on that particular, but I would definitely do some research on that. George Stinney is correct.
And another part of this, as Chris was saying, is the fact that that this was happening all over the South, specifically mostly in Alabama and Mississippi, Louisiana, killings, lynchings, beatings, things of that nature. But this was the first time, in a sense, that it made national news. And it was making national news because of Mamie Till. Mamie Till making the decision, the unprecedented decision, to have her son's body seen by thousands, having news cameras there, having an open casket so that the world, as she said, could see what they had done to her son. So this was a first, and it made national news. And so therefore, people in, you know, Seattle that had no idea what was happening in the southeastern states of America were now getting a glimpse of what was happening. People now in Boston were now getting a glimpse of what was happening in America. People in Cincinnati were getting an opportunity to now see on their television there in black and white what was happening that they had never realized was happening. So it sent shockwaves around the world.
Absolutely. I will say, with the wonderful world of having technology at your fingertips, George Stinney was a 14-year-old young black boy who was convicted of a crime and then 70 years later was exonerated. And I think the caller probably was getting to the villainization of young black boys. In the case of Emmett Till, he was portrayed as a villain from the perspective of those two men that took the horrendous action to take his life. But you also see young black men being villainized even when it comes to the court system, presumed being guilty before the evidence comes about or the correct evidence.
And in George Stinney's case, thanks to the technology again, he was convicted and actually executed in 1944.
Oh, is this in South Carolina?
Right, for the murder of two white girls. And as Chris was saying, 70 years later, oh, wait a minute.
We were wrong. And I think it's very important to understand, to personalize this. You're talking about an individual, their life is forever changed, and that affects other people's lives. That is someone's son, that is someone's brother, that is someone who could have been a doctor, could have made a wonderful contribution to our world. And also that legacy is gone. That person could have been a great father, could have been a great teacher. And so when that action is taken over hatred in such a degrading way, lives are impacted more than just the individual that dies.
Mike, you were talking about the difficult decision that Emmett's mother made to have an open casket funeral. How did that galvanize the civil rights movement? How did that give a spark to it?
You know, I have to say that it galvanized the civil rights movement in similar ways to the Black Lives Matter movement that is happening now. Because if you think about the correlation between Mamie Till having that body be photographed and that picture be displayed in newspapers and periodicals around the country, and then a few years later we have, or that following fall, we have the Montgomery bus boycott. Montgomery bus boycott could have been an altogether quiet boycott or unknown boycott, but because, again, of news footage, of pictures of Rosa Parks on that bus or being taken off that bus or being fingerprinted, you know, we now know of that story. And at that time period, then people around the country began to know what was happening in Montgomery, Alabama. And the same goes for the Greensboro sit-ins and so on and so forth. Technology, as it were, was bringing these things to light. Technology today is bringing police brutality as well as other incidents to light. Mamie Till made a very difficult choice in having her son's body be photographed and filmed and then viewed. There's film footage that we use within our my play, as well as this film. There's actual film footage of the many thousands of people walking past Emmett's body in that funeral home over the course of a day and a half or 2 days. That was unheard of at that particular moment, but Mamie knew that if she did not do that, if she did not make that decision, that her son would be one of the forgotten ones, mm-hmm. and she was not going to allow that to happen.
Mind you, did Rosa Parks have this on her mind when she refused to give up her bus seat? Was that maybe something that was in the back of her mind? She's thinking, after what happened to Emmett, I'm not going to do this.
Yeah, I mean, there are historian accounts that say that Rosa Parks was reading about Emmett in the newspaper, even though this was December. That is to say, Rosa was arrested on December 5th of 55, and Emmett's case was throughout the summer and early fall of 55. But I can imagine that perhaps newspaper accounts would still be being written about this case because it was so widely known. But yes, I absolutely believe, and historians have said that she was thinking about Emmett Till when she was arrested on that bus, that enough was enough. And I imagine many of the young people that took part in the Montgomery bus boycott, because it was a young movement, many of the young individuals that took part in the Montgomery bus boycott did have Emmett Till on their minds when they were walking for that 381 days, I believe.
Yeah, it's without question that the Emmett Till story was an impetus for the civil rights movement. And so actions of sit-ins and marches, that legacy of resistance was continuing from stories like Emmett Till. And I also find it fascinating as far as the use of technology goes way back. When you go to the antebellum period, the use of technology was the printing press. The printing press was used to spread the word to enlighten people about slavery. And then you have, you know, photography coming about. And today, current day, it's the video, it's the smartphone and things, and shedding light on these incidents, and so there is a legacy, there is a continuum of the use of technology in a way to portray a story or tell a story that goes beyond, in this case, beyond Chicago, beyond Money, Mississippi, for not only the nation, but for the world to be exposed to the story.
Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam were both acquitted by an all-white jury of men. But then later on, Chris, they admitted they had killed Emmett. What brought that confession out?
I believe they were doing an interview for a magazine, and so they couldn't be retrialed.
Double jeopardy,
yeah,
can't be retried.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And so they admitted. From their perspective, it could be received as a badge of honor. Yes, we did this, you know.
Right.
And so they didn't have any jeopardy of going to jail or receiving a death sentence for murdering. But it also reveals, in their arrogance, it reveals the problems and issues that are with the social system, but also the judicial system of that time.
Weren't they paid for the interview? Wasn't that?
I believe
they were paid $4,000 for that interview. They were interviewed in and it was Look magazine. And what they do is they tell a half story in it. They tell a story that that is improbable in a sense, because they talk about certain parts of that night that Emmett was taken, but then they contradict themselves from the trial in a number of ways. They contradict Carolyn Bryant, the wife. Not only that, they contradict the evidence of Emmett's body. You know, you realize that Emmett had to be killed long before he got to the banks of the Tallahatchie.
And Mike, before we wrap up this segment, I do have to ask you something about your part in the film. You actually played, what, 36 different roles in this movie? Is that correct?
Absolutely.
What is it like to do that? How, as an actor, can you do that? Especially when you're dealing with such an emotional topic as this one.
Well, actually, it's easier for film. I do it on stage. I play that number of roles on stage when I'm doing the play, and the director of the film, Rob Underhill, came to me some years ago after he had seen the production and said, you know, that he had an idea, and his idea was to make a film of the play. And I said, brilliant. I've always wanted to do that. I think that's a great idea. I know some great actors that can fill out the rest of the roles. And he said, oh, no. Just you.
Wow.
you sure you want to do that? Because I don't, you know, I'm not the kind of actor that goes and puts on, you know, a wig and all these kinds of things, because I play female characters within the play, young and old, white and black. And he said, no, I don't think it needs it. And he's right. It didn't need it. All it needs is locations, a strong script, and an understanding of loss. And that's what comes across in the film. It's a strong film, and we've won a number of awards for best film nationally as well as internationally, and a few best actor awards as well. So it's a powerful piece.
Well, Mike and Chris, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Okay, thank you. And I just want to say right quickly, if I have a moment, Mike will be performing with the Arts Connect, is one of our community sponsors, on August 12th for a dinner and show. You can actually get information at 522-1410. And then our sponsors with Chubb Group Insurance Companies are a partner for the film series for this Saturday at 1 p.m. So it's an opportunity to be exposed to Mike's brilliant talent.
And the film's going to be shown at the Freedom Center's Harriet Tubman Theater?
That is correct, at 1 p.m. You can visit freedomcenter.org to reserve your spot. It is free and open to the public.
And you can find a link to more information at wvxu.org. And coming up, we'll hear about a program that brings the arts to those in senior centers and nursing homes. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.